Okay, now I will call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Good afternoon, everyone. The first order of business will be to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Becker.
Becker, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolkemot.
Wolkemot, present.
Quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. The next order of business is to approve the minutes from March 17th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman moves approval of the minutes of March 17th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, we are going to start this afternoon with some more presentation of the governor's supplemental budget. And we're going to have the actual bill before us next week. I just want members to know there's been a little delay in, you know, since we're all working virtually and people are at home and things, we've had a little bit of trouble getting the actual document, but we will have that next week. And then we'll be able to move along with the more formal process with that bill. But we have Commissioner Harpstead with us this afternoon to talk about some of what, and other testifiers as well, to talk about what is in it so that we get a nice jump start on this. And we will have the actual bill in front of us on Tuesday. So with that, Commissioner Harpstead, welcome. And please go ahead and present your bill, or the bill that isn't yet.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share the proposals from Governor Walz's supplemental budget that affect human services. Today, you'll also be hearing from our assistant commissioners who will walk through the proposals from their areas that are new or that have changed since we last presented to the committee. The governor's supplemental budget proposals for human services build on the priorities laid out in January. This includes targeted investments that support the agency's mission, measures that reinforce process controls, and efforts to help Minnesota recover from COVID. We don't want to just get back to normal at DHS. We aim to get back to better. While we're encouraged by recent progress fighting COVID, there's no question the burden of the pandemic and its economic fallout have been significant for low-income Minnesotans. Consider that over the past 12 months, the Minnesota Family Investment Program has seen enrollments up 18%, or nearly 5,000 families. The Minnesota Healthcare Programs, Medicaid, and Minnesota Care enrollment is up 11%, 75,866 enrollees. And our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, enrollment is up 11%, or 21,646 families and individuals who need assistance with food security. In the face of this great need, we're grateful for the improved economic outlook for our state. This has allowed us to remove some of the more difficult cuts we proposed in January and make some key investments to help ensure an equitable recovery, all while making sure we are crossing our T's and dotting our I's. Our proposals are based in part on listening we've been doing in the communities we serve. I'm especially proud of our proposal to maintain family connections in foster care, which has been informed by discussions with the community in recent months. Also pleased that we're able to do more for children and their families living in deep poverty. For example, a family of four with an income of no more than $905 a month The governor's supplemental budget funds an annual cost of living adjustment for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. ECOLA will put in motion an automatic increase that will continue to incrementally improve the well-being of children in deep poverty, instead of waiting 35 years to increase it again like we did last time. Moving into some of the proposals that are in the supplemental budget. We want to just review the repayment of tribal MAT and county IMD payments. I appreciate these aren't necessarily in your jurisdiction, but they do relate to Medicaid payments. And so once again, we are asking you to consider paying these overpayments off and putting these issues behind us. They add up to $37.2 million in fiscal 21. Also in our what we call back to better, returning from COVID emergency measures, we are looking at, Kalani, were you going to present this?
I can, if you would like me to.
Why don't you do that? Kalani Moti.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, Ms. Inspector Moti, please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS. And as the Commissioner had said, that we're returning back to better, we're looking at returning some of our COVID emergency measures, specifically in our background studies area, to protect public health and maintain access to services in a safe manner and prevent the spread of COVID-19 and meet requirements to secure federal funding. The commissioner had adopted over 115 waivers and modifications to state and federal laws and exercised other emergency powers under existing law. For background studies, a requirement modification allowed providers to quickly respond to their changing workforce needs, including waiving the requirements for fingerprint-based background studies for most categories and instituting a Minnesota-only background study using the individual's name and date of birth for maltreatment and criminal history for most provider types. There are going to be some challenges in returning to our standard background studies. To date, the waivers resulted in an accumulation of over 135,000 modified or emergency studies using name and date of birth for record identification. And we do anticipate that this number is going to continue to grow as long as the peacetime emergency remains in effect. Following the end of the state of the peacetime emergencies, all study subjects will be required to submit a new background study using fingerprints in order to ensure full compliance with state and federal background checks requirements. The 60-day transition timeframe in current statute is going to be insufficient to allow us to successfully return to compliance while still maintaining our current processing caseload. So our proposal addresses transition time and cost. We will be asking to extend the transition time to 365 days. It would be adding temporary FTEs to handle our increased volume of studies so we can turn things around in a timely manner, and provides a credit for a previous emergency study and covers resubmission costs for studies that are covered under our interagency agreements. With that, am I turning this back over to the commissioner or to Matt Anderson?
Yeah, I think that we're going to, let's just see if there are any. I'm not seeing any right now. And of course, members can also ask at the end if they would like. But I think that the next person here is going to be Matt Burdick is going to step in for Matt Anderson, is my understanding. Mr. Burdick, are you here? Oh, I guess Matt Anderson is going to be still on. Okay. A little mix up here.
That's okay.
Mr. Anderson. Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Again, for the record, my name is Matt Anderson, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And so as we move to the next slide, just want to note that in our healthcare administration and for DHS, high priority is to ensure a smooth transition for our enrollees from the period of time of the federal public health emergency and its requirements for our healthcare programs to getting back to better in a new permanent process. And so we're recommending several actions in our healthcare programs. When I speak of healthcare programs, I mean our medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs to streamline the processes as those programs return to more permanent operations and really to try to minimize the burden our enrollees and our counties and tribal nation partners that are going to be processing enrollments. So the first change I'd like to suggest is the temporary suspension of periodic data matching in our Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, or MET system. This is a data matching function that we, in normal times, are doing on a regular basis. We've suspended it during the public health emergency because we need to keep everyone enrolled in coverage that was enrolled as of March 18th, both in terms of our state policy to make sure that people have access to care, but also to maintain our eligibility for enhanced federal matching funds for our Medicaid program. As we undo or the federal public health emergency ends, we need to be able to go through eligibility and renewal determinations for those enrollees. And the periodic data matching will merely just expand the number of enrollees that are triggered for eligibility determinations. And we in the counties and the tribes won't have the time or the staff ability to be able to go through each of those reports. So we're proposing that this would be suspended for up to 6 months following conclusion of the federal public health emergency while we do those eligibility and renewal determinations. The second is waiving unpaid premiums. Again, as I said, under federal law, we are required to maintain the enrollment of beneficiaries who enrolled as of March 18th, 2020, to get the enhanced federal matching funds. We can't disenroll Medicaid beneficiaries for failure to pay premiums. And we have asked CMS and got authority to apply the same standard for our Minnesota Care program enrollees as well. In the meantime, since March 18th of 2020, obviously there have been people who have been enrolled that have not paid premiums. They've missed a month or more than 1 month and that they have accrued a balance of unpaid premiums. CMS issued guidance indicating that states cannot collect unpaid premiums in the Medicaid program that accrued during the emergency. And this proposal would forgive the unpaid premiums that accrued during the federal public health emergency for our enrollees in Minnesota Care, as well as any of our Medicaid enrollees from a state perspective. Third is ensuring a sound rebasing methodology. Inpatient hospitals are their rates, as well as some of our other providers. Those rates are based on calculations of a given base year, usually two full years behind the current year that we're in. And we look at the services that they provided, the cost of those services in that base year, and that's what's used to calculate their current rates. For the rebasing that was scheduled for hospitals this year in 2021, disturbance of 2020 and the claims that people are experiencing, we are looking to be able to change our rate basing methodology so that we can use more than a single year worth of claims to smooth out any unique years disruptions in utilization, as well as being able to make sure that the years that we are using are really reflective of the provider's costs. So that proposal would allow for more flexibility to ensure that our provider rates really are based on sound methodology, and that we can make those changes or make those rates even when we have insufficient claims in a given time period. And then finally, electronic income verification. Federal law requires employers to be contacted to verify the work status and income of applicants for our cash and healthcare programs. DHS has a contract with a vendor to enable us to pay a fee for each employer contact. The number of employer contacts, again, is expected to rise significantly during the period in which the emergency measures are come to an end. And so we would need more funding to be able to do that. Next slide, please. We also have proposals to allow for DHS to contract with the vendors and do the work necessary to conduct a comprehensive study that would examine options to leverage federal funding, federal waivers or authorities to be able to expand access to healthcare for more Minnesotans, to examine the adequacy of our current outpatient payment rates and identify a comprehensive approach to a revised rate setting for our state healthcare program. So Minnesota has a long and proud history of healthcare innovation. We have been at the forefront of expanding access to coverage for our residents, yet too many Minnesotans continue to struggle to get access to healthcare coverage and the services that it provides. The complexity of our rules related to eligibility and financing within our healthcare system, uncertainty at the federal level, policy disruptions have all been barriers to creating a more strategically aligned way to ensure that Minnesotans have access to healthcare coverage and services. Yet now there are increasing signals that the federal government may be supportive of state actions to expand healthcare coverage, including through a public option that would give residents the opportunity to select a different type of healthcare coverage than what would be offered through normal markets. Minnesota has an opportunity to take action on a meaningful path forward that leverages these federal opportunities and improves Minnesotans' access to healthcare coverage and services. So what we are proposing is that we look at a comprehensive study of what those options may be, as well as a study of our outpatient service provider rates for healthcare professionals, physicians, outpatient hospital services, those kinds of things. These are our current rates are very outdated. We've got various add-ons and supplemental payments and enhancements that have just been layered over and over in a very outdated fee schedule that's created a lack of transparency, is overly complex and is confusing for providers. And largely it's ineffective, has been proven ineffective at addressing health disparities and promoting better quality of care. And so a comprehensive approach to that rate setting would help us improve the payments for our providers and the method in which those rates are delivered, as well as being able to establish however the state decides to move forward with a public option or other coverage expansions, to be able to do it on a sound rate methodology basis that would avoid undermining the integrity or the soundness of our provider reimbursements. With that, I am going to pause and now turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Matt Burdick.
All right, and Mr. Anderson, before you go, I mean, I do see we have one question from another member, but I just wanna clarify, are you talking about when you, in the hospital rebasing piece and in what you were just talking about, are you talking about fee for service, managed care rates, or both? I assume at least fee for service, but I want to know if managed care is in there as well.
So these are for the rate study as well as for rebasing of hospital or other providers' rates that are based on a base year. We're talking about fee for service payment rates. So managed care organizations continue to have flexibility, very, very limited circumstances, but continue to have flexibility to negotiate rates with providers. Each plan, each managed care organization does its own rate negotiations with providers and have different rates for different services, different providers. What we're talking about is the fee-for-service system. Now, to be clear, some managed care organizations use the fee-for-service system as their base. We're going to start with fee-for-service and we're going to add on a percentage or we're going to adjust it or something like that. But that's their choice and their flexibility to do that.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I was just wondering about the study on expanding the public option that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And what sort of timeline would that study take? And when might we have any information on that, please?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the proposal that we are putting forward for your consideration, obviously the legislature has a significant role to play in setting that deadline, but we are proposing that it would be due January of next year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one other quick question, since I know all questions are allowed here. Can you just tell me what periodic data matching entails briefly and just a little background on that?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bierman. Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. And I apologize for that we get lost in our own terminology sometimes. Periodic data matching, and for simplistic terms, is basically electronic systems that ping other data sources, such as employment information. And so it provides reports on people who are enrolled in our programs who now have, for example, the reports that we would get would be people that have potentially gotten new jobs or new levels of income that would make them no longer qualified for our programs, or who have had other life changes that might affect their eligibility. And I want to be clear that the periodic data matching and the reports that it generates are data indications. It doesn't mean that the person is no longer eligible. It means that there's data sources that might indicate that the person. So when we get those reports, our staff or county staff or tribal staff have to contact enrollees and verify, is the new information that we're getting from our databases, is that correct? Are you still eligible? Has there been a change in circumstances, what have you? And so there's the reports themselves do not determine eligibility. Those are things that we follow up on, but we use those as a way of trying to maintain program integrity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And Representative Bierman, as you might imagine, there's a lot more that, you know, that particular topic could take up a lot of time. I think the key point here is that this is a program integrity system, and it's somewhat of a recent one. And so there might be some more conversation about that as things go along here. Okay, I think we can go on then with the presentation. And I think then, Mr. Burdick, are you, on my list, I have next Mr. Greenman, but are you, you've got something in the middle, go ahead.
Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. Very quickly, I'm just gonna cover one item that's changing from the original budget that we presented to you all several months ago. In that budget, there's a proposal from the Blue Ribbon Commission related to durable medical equipment and changing some of the payment rates for that. One piece that we received significant feedback related to that is due to pediatric ventilators. And several years ago, the legislature made a decision to use state funding to increase the payment rates for those particular products. And so in the revised governor's budget, this retains the current funding levels and payment rates for those products. There's also on this slide several grants. That's not relevant to this committee's jurisdiction. However, we did present those in our initial budget rollout, so just wanted to have that for members' information. And that will conclude our presentation, and happy to take additional questions.
All right, thank you very much. And so I have also Mr. Greenman on my list, but I take it is he just here for questions? I'm not even sure if he's here, actually.
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair, I'm here for questions.
All right, thank you. Okay, so are there any questions for members on any of what you just heard? And you do have the slides in your packets too. Representative Dama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe the question would be best to Commissioner Harpstead. How many total FTEs is DHS looking to roll out this type of a budget?
Commissioner Harpstead.
I'm gonna defer that to our Dave Greenman, who adds up numbers like that for us.
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. That is a good question. I can probably get back to you with that number. I don't have it at the top of my head right now, but I can certainly get back to you with that number. I probably can find it in about 5 minutes. So if you want to wait, I can come back or whatever.
All right. Well, Mr. Greenman, why don't we move on here and just, I guess, let us know when you have that. We'll see if we'll get you back in here for the answer. Representative Damath, anything else?
Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
No more homework to give the department here that they can come back with? No? Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions for members? All right, not seeing any. So I think that we According to my list here, we now have the Department of Health, some folks from the Department of Health talking about some of their parts of the budget. Margaret Kelly, are you here with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
All right, great. So I think, so Commissioner Harpstead, I think your part is kind of concluded here. So thank you very much for your presentation and for being with us today.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members.
All right. So Deputy Commissioner Kelly, welcome. Oh, and I see, okay, go ahead. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your piece of the presentation here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the invitation to come and talk to you again about the Department of Health's budget. Commissioner Malcolm sends regrets that she wasn't able to join you all today for this presentation, but she'll come back to your committee as soon as possible. I just really appreciate the hopefulness of Commissioner Harpstead's budget theme, Back to Better. And I really look forward to achieving that for the Department of Health and for public health in general in the coming years, and hope that this budget is for us a start to that as well. I have with me today Joshua Bunker, our Chief Financial Officer, who's going to walk you through two categories of revisions to our budget that have been made since we were last in front of your committee. And one is the governor's revisions that he has announced just last week or earlier this week, changes that have been made to our budget with the recent budget forecast. But second, federal funding. We are now hearing about additional resources coming through the America Recovery Plan and additional federal funding to help us with financing our COVID response and our vaccine rollout. And we have some high-level estimates that Joshua Bunker can walk you through as well. So with that, I will turn it over to him.
All right, thank you. Mr. Bunker, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, good afternoon to you. We have just a short and sweet couple of slides to present the few changes that we have.
Okay, and don't forget to state your name and your title, please.
Thank you very much. Joshua Bunker, Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Health. Thank you, Madam Chair. Next slide, please. The last time we were before you, we presented our base budget, and what we were hoping at the time was an end to pandemic activities. Just highlighting on this slide, the area in brackets in the upper right that represent the funding that we are anticipating, estimated amounts now from the American Rescue Plan and FEMA amounts that are going to be used for a number of reasons, not only limited to testing and vaccination, but also other areas that I'll share in a moment. I just wanted to present the slide of the committee so that you can see the impact of the continuing economic recovery activities that are happening and appear at this time to be moving toward the Department of Health's mission and activities. Next slide, please. What we understand at this point are eight funding areas out of the rescue plan that we believe are heading toward health. I have estimated at the top of this slide, because we're really only certain at this point in a dollar amount for the top item, which is the WIC cash vouchers. These other areas, we have developed these numbers comparing the last budget that was passed in December at the federal level to what is included within the American Rescue Plan. And so you see that there are funds in addition to WIC for evidence-based home visiting, clean air, safe drinking water, youth suicide prevention, early intervention, health corps support to professionals in the area. And then the last three grants are those that might seem more the traditional pandemic response type of activities. The third from the bottom are monies for testing and for public health infrastructure and system improvements. Second from the bottom, an additional $85 million for vaccine-related activities. And then the last of it at the bottom of the page is for the genomic work around the variants that are happening now, so we can gain a better understanding of how those variants are occurring and moving across the state so we can plan response and mitigation actions. Next slide, please. This slide is just highlighting the areas in which the very few changes in the governor's rec will occur, all within the general fund in terms of impacts to funds. Next slide, please. The specific items that are impacted will show up in blue on this slide, and these are the revised items themselves. The tobacco vaping prevention and cessation supplemental item is submitted immediately after, a couple days ago, a next tobacco settlement was reached. The tobacco settlement details, as we understand, are on slide 7 of this packet. I won't go through them now, but they're for you and members' reference at this time. The reductions include changing from ongoing to one time for the home visiting grants and for the fetal alcohol syndrome grants. The eHealth Advisory Initiative reduction would continue into the future, but the Merck formula grants, those medical education research cost grants, were removed during this recommended budget at this time. And there is one shift that the governor has recommended at this time, and that's in the prescription drug transparency item. That has to do with delays in being able to implement activities due to COVID, where we would move $210,000 into fiscal year 22 from an amount that was appropriated this year and cancel back to the fund that $395,000. Next slide, please. A change that will not result in any impact to the fund is in the vital records area. At present, folks who need vital records usually go to county offices, et cetera, and make transactions in person. This would enable those transactions to occur electronically. And that enablement would be accomplished through a third-party vendor that would pay a nominal fee to those who are looking for that service, perhaps $2 per transaction is what I've heard for folks who are looking for those vital records. The next two slides in the packet, again, are just informational, and that concludes the items in the governor's recommended budget for the Department of Health. Any questions?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bunker. And I see we do have a question. If you could just back up a couple of slides to the one with the tobacco settlement. I just wanted to flag this for members that, remember, we heard a bill from Representative Morrison, I believe, or maybe it was Representative Schultz, one of the two, to take this settlement money that we then didn't know if it was coming and use it for tobacco cessation activities. And that's what, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Bunker, that's what is being shown in the budget here, is that very thing. Capturing that money. Thank you. All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bunker, for the presentation. Just a quick question. On the money that's coming from the American Rescue Program, that's one-time money. So in your purview, we don't want to spend one-time money on ongoing expenses. It's the quickest way to go bankrupt in your personal life or business. So is there a mechanism that you're using to make sure that money is used on a one-time basis spent rather than creating ongoing programs that will demand more money in the future?
Mr. Bunker.
Madam Chair, Representative, these funds will be treated similar to other one-time federal funding, where we are experiencing a surge in activity, and whether that is distributing supplemental WIC payments to folks or addressing sequencing activities for gene variants at this time. We are not looking at continuing expenses, although we would look at these monies as investments to update systems where the value of those upgrades would allow us capacity into the future, but not have that continuing spending, if you will, into the future in those areas.
Mm-hmm. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just one follow-up question I've had for a long time. And as long as we have the fiscal or CEO of financial analysis here. Do we have any programs that help people get off of government dependency, to become independent and not need government assistance? Are there any programs that we have that do that?
Well, Representative Gernhagen, that would have been a better question for DHS. This is the health department now. So I think you might have missed your opportunity there. But you know what? Today is kind of, that is such a broader question that probably would have belonged in one of the overview presentations we had. So I don't know if we're going to be able to get into that here. Certainly, we wouldn't ask Mr. Bunker to answer that question because I think that's right outside of his responsibility. So if that's okay, I know we've still got people from DHS on the call, and I think they could probably get back with you and on that question, if that's okay. Representative Ryer and then Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bunker. I have a question on page 3, that big line, the third one from the bottom, epidemiology and laboratory capacity. I think I heard you mention part of that would be about data systems and the availability of data and managing data. I don't remember, it went by a bit quickly. And depending on what your answer is, I may have a follow-up, but I would just be interested in having that described a little bit more, that aspect.
All right, Mr. Bunker.
Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, we believe that the funding stream is similar to some of the other ELC enhancing detection monies that will come into the state. We are waiting for the final guidance around these amounts, as well as waiting for the final amounts themselves. If these monies could be spent in a similar way to the others that we have had, some of them would be targeted toward interoperability and system interaction and data sharing, certainly.
Representative Ryer?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so my follow-up is I had a conversation with Dakota County public health people as part of local Public Health Day on the Hill. And they were talking about challenges in the data systems, and it was with specifically with DHS, I believe, but how they can't necessarily get the granularity of data related to race, some other characteristics, that just the data systems don't enable the valuable questions to be answered. And I just wondered if that would be part of the possible arena for using some of these funds. It would also, just to clarify, that would be, Mr. Representative Gernhagen's point, that would be, in my view, a one-time investment. So I'm trying to think of ways to make good one-time investments that serve us for a long time. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I think we're thinking along the same lines here. But Mr. Bunker, anything you want to respond or even Deputy Kelly, if you wanted
sure.
To speak I'm to
happy,
that.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I'm happy to take the first stab and feel free to fill in behind me, Joshua. One of the things that is so critical in our COVID response is the ability to share information electronically, meaning quickly, and electronically for quickness and for accuracy, between laboratories and the Department of Health, between our local partners and our federal partners. And so that is one reason why the federal government is putting resources into states to improve that ability to share data electronically between entities. And it goes beyond just the accurate data around race or ethnicity that locals may need, but it's all forms of breaking down the data in ways in which we can use it at each level of government to help with decision making. And so clearly some one-time investments in improving our electronic reporting at all levels and with all of our partners is the type of work we're doing. I think what Dakota County may have mentioned was issues that they're having with DHS systems. We have done a lot of work both with DHS and with locals on race and ethnicity data that we're collecting so that we're sure we're all collecting it consistently and can share it back to them. So we will use these fundings to improve our ability to share information within our systems. So.
All right, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also on that slide, I was interested in the National Health Service Corp, which is addressing health professional shortage areas. And, you know, maybe just if somebody could send me a little bit more information about what that program is like. I have a constituent that has been coming forward to me with especially personal care attendants and such a shortage in that area. So just, you know, that's something I'd like to hear more about, but I don't know necessarily this is the time and the place for that. But thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we learn more about that aspect of the funding, we'll share that with you too.
Great. Thank you. Well, that's great. And thank you for that. And I just want to kind of toss in here that one of the things I'm really hoping that we can do with some of this resource from the American Rescue Plan, kind of the one-time, using one-time resources to position us better for the future. I think we all know that the pandemic really caught our whole country kind of off guard, that our public health infrastructure is not where it needs to be. And we've had to really build it on the fly and not always. You know, it should have been there in the beginning, or a lot of it, more of it should have been there. And we've underfunded it for years and years. So not only talking about the state health department, but the local health departments that do the on the ground work and really building that up so that the next time this happens, and it will happen, not necessarily with COVID, but it'll happen. And in fact, it does happen periodically at a much smaller scale that we have different kinds of public health emergencies. We need to be much better prepared. So I'm really hoping that some of this additional resource will allow us to do that so that we don't have to build it from scratch again. And we can be much quicker. And obviously this has really shown a light on public health and how important it is running in the background, usually unnoticed by most of the public, but so important as the basis for our whole economy, which unfortunately we've seen over this past year. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is exactly how we share that hope with you for this funding. And that while we recognize that it is one time, it's available to us over several years to use, but we do plan to help to use it to help understand what we may need going forward to be better prepared for the next pandemic, hopefully not in our lifetimes.
Yes, indeed. And on my list, I also have Laura Olivan. Is she here?
Madam Chair, she is. We brought her along to answer questions anyone may have about the settlement and the governor's.
All right. Okay, great to know. All right, are there other questions from members? All right, not seeing any. So thank you very much for the presentation. We'll let you get back to your other work. And I wonder if Mr. Greenman is here and if he's been able to come up with that answer. There he is.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I apologize. I had the number for the entire agency. I didn't have it for this committee's jurisdiction. The total number of permanent employees that we'd be adding with this package would be 27. About 17 of them would be for the background studies piece. Another six would be for our fraud prevention activities. And then we also have about 34 temporary employees who would be part of our back to better transition from COVID waivers to normal operations. So essentially 27 new full-time permanent FTEs and 34 temporary.
All right, thank you, Mr. Greenman. Any follow-up, Representative Damon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Greenman, for that information. when you talk about this would be the number of FTEs just for this committee's jurisdiction, could you also share what would be outside of our jurisdiction, that along with the governor's proposal, how many total FTEs would we be looking at?
Madam Chair, Representative, we'd be looking at about 67 FTEs. This would be permanent FTEs that would be added. I would also add that we, as you know, you may know, we have in Representative Schultz's committee a proposal to provide an operating adjustment to the direct care and treatment programs we have, and that wouldn't add any FTEs, but it would allow us to maintain about 300 FTEs who we otherwise would have to look at other ways to economize if we didn't get the operating adjustment.
Yeah, and one of the things I hope that we'll have an opportunity to look at more closely, or I think it'll be available in the commissioners. She's recently completed her Operation Swiss Watch. I get her two operations confused, but I saw like a preview, and she presented a graph that showed the growth in FTEs in the department and compared to kind of the growth in, I think, dollars managed or something. Mr. Greenman, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You could correct me if I'm wrong. It's actually quite impressive how flat the growth in personnel in the department have been. And so, you know, when we take these numbers, it's a little bit out of context here when you say, oh, 60, what was it, 67 overall or something like that. This is a very large department that touches the lives of, you know, just in our healthcare programs, well over a million people. And that doesn't even talk about, you know, the employees and the nonprofits and the sort of the vast work of this agency and the huge complexity of the agency. So I hope that as we get, you know, it is, you know, of course, it's important to look at all the different aspects of the budget request, but I hope that we'll be able to keep this in context because, you know, the question is, what do we want? We as legislators really are in charge of what we want the department to do. And if we want them to do it, of course, we should scrutinize their requests. But I think we need to be careful that we understand how that fits into the larger picture. So thank you for the question, Representative Damuth. I think we should probably move on, but I'm sure we'll have more discussion about this topic. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Okay, so we do have some bills on the agenda for today, and we're gonna now turn to House File 2056. Representative Howard is here with us to present House File 2056, and since he's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 2056 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And welcome, Representative Howard. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Glad to be here. House File 2056 is a bill to help provide some peace of mind and assurances that families that need to access life-saving medication will be able to do so on state-regulated health plans. And I just want to, as at the outset, call out members that, you know, the legislature is a contentious place, right? But over the last 2 years, we have done some really impressive bipartisan work in the area of prescription drug policy, from our work to regulate pharmacy benefit managers, to price drug transparency, and to Alex Law. And I really view this bill, along with several others that have been introduced this year and heard in this committee, as another positive step to bend our prescription drug policy towards Minnesotans and who have for years told us and pleaded with us to do things to make prescription drugs more affordable for their families. And that's what this bill will do by placing a copay cap of $25 on both prescription drugs and supplies to manage the cost of insulin, EpiPens, and asthma medication. All three are areas that we've heard about, especially at the Minnesota legislature. We've spent a lot of time talking about insulin these last few years. But asthma medication is another that has seen drastic price increases, with families spending thousands of dollars a year to manage. In terms of EpiPens, I think folks may be familiar with the price gouging that caused escalating prices of EpiPens. A family has submitted testimony saying that they've seen their prices skyrocket to the point where at times their family has chosen between which child to cover or to fill their medication for their EpiPens. And so what this bill would do would say for state regulated health plans, those medications and their supplies would be capped at $25. And I want to specifically highlight the medical supplies component of this. We really kind of didn't scratch the surface talking about medical supplies when it came to the debate over affordable insulin over the last 2 years. But the reality is, for some families, they actually pay more out of their pocket for the supplies to manage their insulin than the actual prescription drugs. It's an issue we need to get our arms around as well, and that's what this bill seeks to do. It is worth noting that this strategy of a copay price cap has been employed successfully in other states, including Colorado. I've been in touch with the legislator who authored the bill in Colorado, who has reported back that it's working well in his state. And over 30 states are considering such legislation, many or most with bipartisan support. I do wish to credit our health plans in one area, in that over the last few years, they have voluntarily capped their copay price for insulin at $25 or below. And so in some sense, this bill would just codify what they've done on a year-to-year basis. And the reality is that would provide quite a bit of peace of mind for families that every year sort of are facing this question of what is, are my costs going to be to manage the prescription drugs for my family? But I call out that they've done this voluntarily, and to note that this policy really isn't out of the realm of what is already standard operating procedure. Lastly, I just want to make sure it's clear that this isn't a solve-all. We're talking about state-regulated health plans that would be impacted by this, not federally regulated ERISA plans. But this bill, along with the suite of some of the other bills that have been introduced this session, really in totality, I think, will help Minnesota become a state that continues to lead on prescription drug affordability. With that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to my testifiers and look forward to the conversation.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Howard. Okay. Well, welcome to the committee, Leah Greenside. Please introduce yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leah Greenside. I live in St. Paul with my husband and two children. I'm a small business owner, and we have an individual health plan through Minsure. My daughter has type 1 diabetes, and I'm here to testify today in support of Representative Howard's efforts to address the cost of medications and supplies for people living with chronic conditions like diabetes. My daughter uses an insulin pump and a continuous glucose monitor, or a CGM, to maintain healthy blood sugar levels. Insulin pumps and CGMs are life-saving technologies that improve both health outcomes and quality of life over basic diabetes tools like syringes and blood glucose meters, but they are too expensive for many diabetics to afford. The retail price of our pump when we bought it 3 years ago was $9,600. Due to our deductible and coinsurance on durable medical equipment, we paid nearly $3,000 out of pocket. But that is only the start. There are disposable pump supplies that need to be replaced every 2 to 3 days. This pump inset costs $24. This little cartridge that holds insulin costs $8. And additionally, each CGM sensor like this lasts 10 days and costs $150. And just while I was waiting to testify, my daughter came in, she pulled out her pump site. So here's a second pump inset for $24 just today that we've had to use. Altogether, last year, we paid about $2,300 for diabetes supplies and another $360 for insulin. This is despite choosing a gold-level plan through Minsure, for which we paid over $16,000 in premiums for our family of four. If we had chosen a bronze level plan with a lower monthly premium, we would have paid somewhere to the order of $5,000 to $6,000 for our dip supplies and medications last year. And almost all of that would have been just in the first months of the year. How many Minnesotans have thousands of dollars available to pay for supplies and medications each January? That's exactly what many Minnesotans face. I'm grateful that the Minnesota health plans voluntarily capped the cost of insulin for their members starting in 2020. We were beneficiaries of that. But I anticipate they'll say that they can't also cap the cost of medication and supplies without raising premiums. I would ask this committee to question that assumption. According to the American Diabetes Association, the estimated annual cost of diabetes in Minnesota is nearly $5 billion. Care for people with diabetes accounts for 1 in 4 healthcare dollars in the United States. Tools that ensure good diabetes management have been shown to be highly cost-effective. Let's not be penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to healthcare. I support Representative Howard's efforts to find ways to reduce and make predictable out-of-pocket costs for people living with chronic conditions. It will not only lead to better health for many Minnesotans, but it's also a smart investment. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Greenside. Appreciate having you here today. Okay. Dan Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The council has met several times with Representative Howard on this issue, including last session when insulin copay caps were a one-time part of the Alexson-Smith Insulin Affordability Act. We completely agree with the concerns raised about the increasing cost of prescription drugs, especially for those drugs that are life-sustaining for diabetes, asthma, and allergies. And as Representative Howard mentioned, you know, we've seen a huge increase on insulin, asthma inhalers, and of course, what happened with EpiPens back in 2016, when officials were brought in front of Congress due to price gouging for raising the price of EpiPens from $57 to $600. Now, as plans, we try to manage those drug benefits so that enrollees can afford access to their medications in the face of these price increases. As was acknowledged last year, council members independently and voluntarily lowered insulin copays in the fully insured market to $25 or less, and some of those are actually at zero. However, we are opposed to the approach in House File 2056 to permanently place copay levels in statute for these three drug classes. If copays are capped at $25, there is a concern that without downward pressure on manufacturers to decrease their prices, those costs will have to be shifted to premiums. Premiums and copays are a reflection of the cost of healthcare, and in this case, the cost to pay for prescription drugs. A cap on copays would only work in containing costs if there were some way to require that drug companies were in turn to freeze their prices. Manufacturers have given no indication the prices will ever be lowered, and past behavior predicts prices will continue to rise. I also want to remind, as was mentioned, committee members that this does only apply to the fully insured market and to CGIP. And so this legislation does not apply to those in the self-insured markets. And lastly, I'd like to note that the state currently has a reinsurance program that's used to pay for high-cost claims associated with chronic conditions, which brings down premiums for everyone in the fully insured market. This program will stop at the end of this year unless the legislature can act to maximize its federal waiver through 2022. Passing House File 2056, along with allowing the reinsurance program to sunset.
Mr. Andreessen, you're on to a different issue, and we don't have time for that issue today. So if you could please wrap it up.
We look forward to working with Representative Howard and others in developing innovative solutions that can put downward pressure on the price of prescription drugs and urge a focus on the root cause of the problem, and that's the prices set by drug manufacturers. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have a question from Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, this will be quick. To the testifier, Mrs. Green said, what was your out-of-pocket cost monthly? I just want to hear that again, please.
Ms. Greenside.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last year, our out-of-pocket costs for our supplies was $2,300, and we paid $360 on top of that for insulin alone.
And that's just for
my daughter, for managing her diabetes, not for other healthcare costs for the family.
Madam Chair, and your premium cost was?
For our family of four, it was $16,000. That includes some reduction for COVID-related reduction.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a quick question for Mr. Andreessen. You said in 2016, the insulin spiked dramatically. Was that related to PBMs keeping the rebates and discounts from the manufacturers, or is it the manufacturers themselves that are raising prices, or are they being, think they have to because the PBMs are keeping the rebates and not passing along to the consumer?
Mr. Andreessen?
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think what I was mentioning was EpiPens being bought by Mylan in 2016. But generally, your question, I can't speak for the PBMs, I don't represent them, but rebates are used to bring down premiums for everybody in our markets.
Representative Grunhagen? Okay. Representative Ackland. Representative Grunhagen. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Yeah. How did the program, this question is for the lady who has the child with diabetes. How did the program that we passed in 2019 affect you? And also, you must be paying full premium. So did you go through MNsure to get the gold plan and didn't qualify for any subsidy on the premiums? It's just you're paying $16,000 a year, thanks to Abomination Care, by the way, but which was supposed to solve those problems, but they made it worse instead. Did you go through MNsure to get that plan and you didn't qualify for any subsidies? And then also, did the bill we passed help you in any way as far as your cost of diabetes of insulin?
And, you know, I'm going to ask Ms. Greenside to respond, but only please on the issues that relate to this bill. I don't think we need to go off onto premium levels. That's a whole other topic. Ms. Greenside.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, that's correct. We have a plan through MNsure. Our premiums, we do not qualify for a premium subsidy. We earn above that cap. And in terms of insulin, we benefited from our insurer voluntarily lowering the price so that we pay a copayment on our insulin now rather than the full price. That is not a direct benefit of Alex's bill. We did not use that program, but it's a benefit of all the efforts that the state, I think, made to pay attention to this issue so that the insurers voluntarily put the copay cap in place.
All right, we're gonna go to Representative
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen, I gave you a latitude before, but Representative Ackland's been waiting comment. And we won't get to our last bill if we don't finish up here. So Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just a clarification for Representative Howard. As I read the bill, it says limit the amount of any copayment to $25 per 1 month supply for prescription drugs prescribed. And so my question is, like, for many diabetics, they use more than one insulin, so they may use a long acting and a short acting. So would this $25 be more of a bundle? So for any insulin you use and supplies, it's $25? Or will it be $25 for your regular, $25 for your NPH, $25 for your needles, $25 for your lancets, et cetera? And I guess I wasn't clear when I read the bill which way this went. So I just wanted clarification.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Ackland. That's a really good question. The intent is to provide sort of consistency and affordability. I want to get back to you to make sure that I can give you the exact right answer. The intent, though, is to make sure that folks have consistent, affordable prescription drug prices from a month-to-month basis.
Right. Okay. All right, good question, and something I guess that needs clarification. Thank you, Representative Ackland.
Thank you.
All right, seeing no further questions on this, I have a quick question myself, and it's for Mr. Andreessen. You know, we're talking here about, as we get into this whole issue of co-pays on drugs, I guess my question is, what is the purpose of co-pays on drugs? Other than obviously shifting the cost of the care to the consumer, other than that, is there a medical purpose or a, you know, is there another purpose, or is this just a cost shift, a cost control strategy? Can you answer that for us, Mr. Andreessen?
Madam Chair, so the way I'd answer it is it's a part of cost sharing for that cost of that, for that product. So as health plans, you know, the premiums and copays that come in are used to pay for prescription drugs or care through a doctor or hospital. And so there's a, you know, a way to kind of shift that around. Either that cost is either through premiums a person pays per month or per according to what they pay for out of pocket for a prescription. And so it's just a different way to pay for those drugs.
All right, thank you. And Representative Grunhagen, you know, I do want to just say we're going to conclude here soon because we have two more bills. Please go ahead.
Yep. I won't ask a question, just make a statement. In my opinion, I agree with Mr. Andreessen. If you go with this, you're going to eliminate market pressures to keep the price down to a certain degree, and the result's going to be the price is going to go up even faster. So what you save on the copay, you're going to pay in higher health insurance premiums. I guarantee it.
All right. So, I'm going to make my statement now, and then I'm going to give Representative Howard a really brief last word before we lay the bill over. And that is, you know, since we're this whole issue about the reinsurance, you know, it's great that we're basically covering costs for insurance companies, the high costs, while we're doing nothing for the consumer who pays these high premiums, they're still high, and then has all these out-of-pockets. And for some consumers, it's almost like not having insurance. They have so many high out-of-pockets. So this seems absurd to me. And as Mr. Andreessen pretty much just told us, this is just a cost shifting thing. And I think that Ms. Greenside said it very well. This is penny wise and pound foolish. If her child gets sick from not having proper equipment, that costs a whole lot more than providing that equipment. So this is really a foolish policy. And I think that Representative Howard's bill is just the ticket, or at least to get started on a fix. Representative Howard, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief. I really appreciate the discussion and the testimony. I guess what I'd leave members with is that what we're after is helping families have a peace of mind that they can afford the prescription drugs. And to put yourselves in the shoes of a family that has the anxiety of month to month knowing if they're going to be able to afford these prescription drugs. And we absolutely do need to put downward pressure on all actors in our healthcare system that generates billions of dollars in profits. And so I would hope that folks would support, for example, Representative Morrison's Drug Affordability Board that would seek to put some restraints on drug prices. It takes all of us, you know, it takes all actors, manufacturers, PBMs, and insurers to have a stake in making our healthcare system work better for patients. And I believe this bill is a step in that direction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Howard. And with that, House File 2056 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So next bill on the agenda is House File 2324. This is my bill, and I'm going to move that House File 2324 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Members, this is just another vehicle bill, and that's all it's doing. We're just making sure that there's a bill if we should need it, and probably won't, but you just never know. And we kind of discussed this when I had the last vehicle bill, so I hope we don't need a lot more discussion here now. Are there any questions to this? All right, not seeing any. So we need to take a vote on this one to move it to Ways and Means. So renew my motion that House File 2324 be moved to Ways and Means, be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Grinhagen?
Now, what is there a fiscal note with this bill, $1.9 million or something? If it's a vehicle bill, why is that? That's my only question.
It's just, Representative Grinhagen, for a fiscal, potential fiscal vehicle, we usually use a fiscal bill as the vehicle bill. And, you know, if we had to do a second omnibus or something like that, you'd want to use this. But what's in the content of it or the cost of it is kind of irrelevant because it's really only being moved as a vehicle. Does that help? Okay.
Yes, thanks.
All right, thank you. All right, Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Leach Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer. Representative Backer. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Damoth, aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grinhagen.
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye.
Did you hear that?
Yep, I got it. Thanks. Representative Keel. Keel, aye.
Aye.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott. Representative Wolgamott. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Munson. Representative Wolgamott. 17 ayes.
All right, thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. So there being 17 ayes, House File 2324 is re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, Representative Quam, would you like to move House File 81 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and also would like to move the amendment.
All right, so Representative Quam is moving the, let's see, it's the 0112 amendment, is that right, Representative Quam?
I believe so. It's a technical change type amendment that is clarifying the interaction between the Board of Pharmacy and the possible U of M to give some support.
Okay, Representative Quam, my understanding is this is a DE amendment.
Correct.
So so why don't we adopt that if that's the correct one? I don't have it on my, the number of it is not on my agenda, but I do have a copy of it. So Representative Quam is moving the delete all amendment that is the label on it is A21-0112. Correct, Representative Quam? Because I know there have been a couple different versions.
I believe that is correct.
Okay. All right. So let's adopt that, and then we can discuss it in the form in which the author would like to. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any
aye.
Opposed? All right. The amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Quam, sorry we're a little short on time, but please go ahead and give us, we do have four testifiers. So Representative Kwan, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as the chair stated earlier, with some of the one-time funding, we're looking at setting the state up for success in the future. And this is the intent of this bill, which is to help the state as a entity to progress pharmacogenomics. It's individualized medicine so that your doctor and you, using your individual genetics, pick the right medicine, avoid the wrong medicine, have a really good shot at the correct first dosage. So on the books, it's to save money. The reason I've been involved for years is the impact on lives. And plus, this is one way to help with the disparities in medical outcomes. And I will let the testifiers speak. And thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kwan. First testifier we have is Dr. Pamela Jacobson. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself, give us your title and affiliation, and please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and distinguished committee members. Thank you. My name is Pam Jacobson, and I'm a pharmacist, and I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I co-lead the University Grand Challenges Initiative that is looking at how pharmacogenomics could be used in Minnesota as a tool to improve medications. Pharmacogenomics is the science of using an individual's DNA to predict how effective or toxic a medication will be for them. We already follow this prescription medicine approach in cancer as we do genetic testing of the cancer, and the anti-cancer medications are then tailored to match the tumor genetics. Every one of us has taken a medication, and 4 out of 5 of us have an inherited genetic variant that could affect how effective or safe a medication could be. Here's an example. Clopidogrel, also known as Plavix, is used to treat heart attacks and strokes. But between 40 and 50% of East Asians and Pacific Islanders have a gene variant that makes Plavix less effective. Importantly, in February of this year, the manufacturers of Plavix were ordered to pay the state of Hawaii more than $834 million for failing to warn consumers about the risk of Plavix, a significant portion of whom have this genetic ancestry. While a handful of organizations across the country now use pharmacogenomics, no state has yet taken a comprehensive evaluation or implementation. And most Minnesotans do not have access to pharmacogenomic guided care. As I mentioned, we are leading an initiative to advance equitable implementation of pharmacogenomics in Minnesota. Our efforts developed from a small university group to a multi-institutional group. All participants are excited about collaborating to bring pharmacogenomics to the state or use this technology to benefit their own patients. But while it seems it may not be necessary to have state involvement to bring together a group, there is a limit to what we can do without an endorsement and a mandate. That is why we ask you for this measure to be passed and provide authorization for a task force of experts to deliver a clear and data-informed report on the benefits, opportunities, and challenges of pharmacogenomics, and a roadmap for scaling up equitably. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Dr. Gregornik. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee. My name is David Gregornik, and I am the Director of Clinical Pharmacogenomics at Children's Minnesota. Prior to Children's Minnesota, I worked for 18 years at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, a pioneer in pediatric pharmacogenomic research. Because of the strong scientific evidence supporting its use, every child that receives care at St. Jude is offered pharmacogenomic testing, and I saw firsthand the value of pharmacogenomics in optimizing medication use in our patients. I was recruited to Children's Minnesota to create and lead a new pharmacogenomics program. Our service sees patients with cancer, mental health issues, and other medically complex conditions who are struggling with ineffective medications and toxicities. We are one of the only clinics in Minnesota and the Upper Midwest that offers formal pharmacogenomic testing for children and adolescents. There are a number of reasons why Children's Minnesota is one of only a few places offering this type of care. I can't deal it. Go into the details here due to time, but they're included in my written testimony. But at Children's Minnesota, we have successfully addressed many of these barriers. But few other organizations have the expertise and resources to implement pharmacogenomic guided care. Hence, the majority of Minnesota residents do not have access to the benefits of pharmacogenomic testing. I would like to tell a story about one of my first patients at Children's Minnesota. When I first met her, she was 19 years old, had an 8-year history of major depression with multiple hospital admissions and several suicide attempts. Her list of unsuccessful medications over the preceding 8 years was long, with many of those medications causing intolerable side effects, nausea, diarrhea, excessive sweating, and hot flashes that prevented her from taking the medications as prescribed. She underwent pharmacogenomic testing, and her results revealed that she had a decreased ability to metabolize or break down many of the medications that had caused her side effects. A new medication was selected based on her test results. She tolerated this new medication and was able to take the medication as ordered. Within a few short weeks, she was showing signs of improvement, and eventually her psychiatrist was actually able to stop some of her additional supportive medications that she had been taking for mood and to help with sleep. Her parents were overjoyed with her response, and later that year, she was able to take a full load of classes in college for the first time. She continues to do well on her current medications. If we had been able to test her earlier, I believe we could have gotten her on an effective medication faster, preventing this prolonged experience with adverse drug reactions. In closing, I strongly support the establishment of a pharmacogenomic task force and would be willing to serve on that task force to benefit the citizens of Minnesota, especially our children and adolescents.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Dr. Bishop. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and distinguished committee members. For the record, my name is Jeff Bishop, and I'd like to highlight the importance of Bill HF-81 to mental health. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and I'm a board-certified psychiatric pharmacist with pharmacogenomics expertise. I spent the past 16 years conducting research, teaching, and clinical consultations related to mental health pharmacogenomics. Most of us here know of a close friend or family member experiencing challenges related to a mental illness. The hardships, illness, and illness experienced by many over the past year due to the pandemic certainly hasn't helped us, and we may only be just starting to see some of the mental health impacts. Only a third of patients achieve remission from initial treatments for many mental illnesses, and many persons require trials of multiple different medications over the course of many months or even years. 25 to 50% of us have a genetic variation in at least one of the two genes responsible for metabolizing many of the drugs used to treat common mental illnesses. There are many tests available to determine these factors, but at this time, they're not part of standard of care practices in mental health. Unfortunately, they are only occasionally recognized and considered after patients have already failed many medications. An example of this is a gentleman in his late 20s who was 6 years into a debilitating struggle with depression and OCD. Before being referred to us, he was tried on 3 to 4 different drug combinations per year with efforts to maximize doses in attempts to get him better. He came to us confused, irritable, anxious, and with an array of side effects. In pharmacogenetic testing that we facilitated, identified deficiencies in 2 enzyme pathways relevant to both his current and past medications. His antidepressant levels were in fact 3 times higher than the upper end of the safe and therapeutic range, and he had been unknowingly and unintentionally prescribed way too much medication, and many of his symptoms were due to too much drug in his system. A low-dose treatment plan was initiated based on this information, which helped the patient respond and tolerate his medications. This is an example of 6 years of medication and illness struggles that could have been avoided if the patient's doctor had access to pharmacogenomic information sooner. Our bill establishes a foundational step to make this information accessible in our state. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bishop. And final testifier is Cody Weiberg. Dr. Weiberg. Okay. Dr. Weiberg, are you here? Oh, there he is.
Okay. I am. Sorry, just had to adjust my settings here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And I do have to say the Board of Pharmacy members themselves have not considered this bill yet at one of their regularly scheduled public meetings, but they will be doing so next Wednesday at March 24th, on March 24th. I do believe that the members are likely to support this bill and the idea of having the Board of Pharmacy administer the proposed task force. Pharmacogenomics has been around for a while, but activity in this field does seem to be increasing quite a bit. Just as an example, early in my career, I was a psychiatric pharmacist, and we had nothing like this that we could use for our patients in the state psychiatric hospital system. Now, I think the value of having a task force at this time is to try to study the issues involved before any developments might outpace any statutes or guidance that might be necessary. Not saying that it will be necessary, but it could be. So, for example, I think the task force should consider such issues as the ethics of using genetic data to tailor drug therapy, informed consent, data practices issues, how is genetic data safeguarded in this context, who can access it, under what circumstances, how do current federal and state health data privacy laws apply to this, and do they need to be tweaked? And then how would having tailored medications affect prescribing and dispensing? And then finally is how can pharmacogenomics be equitably provided to traditionally underserved communities? I do think it makes sense for the board to administer the task force with the ability to work with the university collaboratively. I think the board, our emphasis is on public safety, and we could focus on those aspects. We do have licensed pharmacists that could do some assistance with the research, especially issues concerning ethics, informed consent, and data practices. I also assume that at some point, the board will be asked by elected officials to weigh in on potential legislation or rules. But I do think the university would probably be better suited to do some of the basic research that needs to be done, and maybe some of the surveys that might be need to be done. So I think the board and the university working together would actually create some synergy in studying this issue.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Yep. Sorry to cut you off.
No,
we have only 3 minutes left in the hearing, and we have two members with their hands up. So, Representative, I think it's Representative Breyer first and then Bonner, but we do have to be done in 3 minutes.
Representative Breyer. Very briefly, I'll be very brief, Madam Chair, because happily Dr. Weiberg raised one of the issues, or the main issue. I wanted to just speak to the only concerns I have, which are really around ethics and appropriate use of the data. I do love the advancement of treatment and care and the appropriate medication of people tailored to them. I worry about life insurance companies, health insurance companies, other businesses obtaining this information and using it in unfriendly ways to people and not in the interest of their health. So I was encouraged to see the ethicist on the board in the proposed legislation. And I know we probably don't have time for comments, so I will leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I'll try to be really brief. But, you know, really from the top down, you know, we know that bodies are really complex and the response to drug therapies is often a mystery. What works for one person doesn't work for the other. But we've been using this successfully in areas like cancer and mental health. It has incredible potential. And this task force gives us an opportunity to be sort of on the leading edge of this emerging technology. But, you know, realistically, with that opportunity comes great responsibility, as Representative Ryer referred to, and Dr. Weiberg. You know, while we can potentially improve outcomes and reduce costs, we also have to be really conscious of how we handle these emerging technologies. So I think having a task force to really be on the cutting edge and getting ahead of this issue is something that I strongly support.
All right, thank you. Representative Quam, 30 seconds, final 30 seconds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Bonner and the others that have helped with this. And I think this will help us be in position to do a better job in the future. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you to the testifiers. Thank you, Representative Quam and members. So House File 81 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And with that, I hope everyone has a wonderful, restful weekend, and we will see the members back here on Monday. We stand adjourned.